The Buddha, Sri Dharma, Sri Sangha. I want to talk this morning about two related things. The first is, since the eternal is the reality of all things, why we don't see it. And the second is how it compassionately reveals itself to us in time of need. So we can recognize it. I use two scriptures. The first is a scripture on the immeasurable life, the Tathagata. It says, to ferry beings, sentient beings to the other shore, I revealed to them by skillful means my parinirvana, the Buddha's entry into enlightenment, the full final enlightenment. Yet truly I am not extinct, but always abiding here, giving voice to the Dharma. I continue to abide in this world, using my spiritual powers to make confused creatures not see me, though I am near, so that they may look on me as extinct and make offerings to my relics. Cherishing longing desires and giving rise to hearts thirsting for hope, when these sentient beings in faith and humility, honest and forthright in manner, gentle in thought, wholeheartedly yearn to see the Buddha, not begrudging even their own lives, then I, with all the Sangha, appear together on the divine vulture peak. The vulture peak, the place from which the Buddha proclaimed the Dharma. The basic problem with self is that self is always looking for what's in it for me. And within the true self, within the greater self, within that which transcends the selfish self utterly and completely, there's no what's in it for me. So we could take what I just read and just change it a little bit, change the words a little bit. It makes an interesting point. I'll change some of it. I'll change here. Think of it now as not as Shakyamuni Buddha, but as the Eternal speaking. I continue to abide in this world, but confused creatures, because of their point of view of self, do not see me, though I am near. So they think on me as extinct. But out of the very pain of that conviction of separation from true reality and cosmic love, within these beings, longing desires arise. And this gives rise to hearts thirsting for hope. Then when these sentient beings, in faith and humility, honest and forthright in manner, gentle in thought, wholeheartedly yearn to see their true nature, yearn for reunion with their true nature, not begrudging even their own lives, being willing to give everything, then I, with the whole of existence revealed in immaculacy, appear before them and teach the true meaning of reality, the true nature of reality. You only need to do a little tweaking here and you see what it's talking about, you see? We don't see what's everywhere because we look with the wrong eyes. We look with the eyes of self. And self cannot see. The illusion of self is like a veil between us and reality. The love of the eternal. When that veil dissolves, every woman looks, there's the love of the eternal. Within the most horrific circumstances, within the most benign circumstances, it doesn't matter anymore. Every woman looks, within the deepest suffering, within the worst horrors of existence, there's that love too. It's everywhere. External things aren't the true reality. External things fundamentally don't matter. We're not blinded by the illusion of self, by selfish longing. The wonderful thing is, in the teachings on reharmonization, which you could also call the teachings on conversion, is the fundamentally important point that I always come back to, that none of that confusion and pain of selfishness goes to waste. It's precisely out of that muck of suffering and delusion that the lotus blossom, the plant of the lotus, can bloom. And the real miracle of existence is that this conversion can happen and does happen. You know, it's talking about it right here. You know, it's talking about it right in what I just read. I continue to abide in this world using my spiritual powers to make confused creatures not see me, though I am near, so that they may look on me as extinct and make offerings to my relics, cherishing longing desires and giving rise to hearts thirsting for hope. Right out of our confusion, by some miracle beyond our capacity to comprehend at all, the eternal leads us to enlightenment. And again, from the point of view of self, we're struggling and thrashing our way through this stuff. From the point of view of the eternal is always guiding and leading us, pulling us, drawing us towards itself, out of the confusion. And not just out of the confusion itself is the very soil from which the plant of enlightenment grows. No matter how one experiences it, no matter how one conceives of it, I don't believe you can ever even begin to grasp how this happens. Nothing is outside the Buddha nature. Nothing is wasted. All the greed, hate, and delusion are put to good work. All the mass of accumulated suffering and pain becomes the mud from which the lotus plant can grow. One day flower. There are above all two times in a person's life when the veil dissolves. One is the time of Kensho, when the veil dissolves. In the first Kensho, it dissolves very briefly. In the third kensho, it dissolves much for much longer time. And then, as the scripture says, we see the Buddha. There's a saying that River Master used to quote, and I don't know if it comes from the Bible, it's from some Christian source, "No man can look upon God and live." The eternal reveals itself to us completely, and yet we're always aware that there is, you know, at the time of Kensho that happens, and yet we're still aware that while there is that always oneness, there is also the always difference. I am not God, and there is nothing in me that is not of God. Another thing our master used to quote, and this is from Buddhism, from Zen probably, although I don't know the source. Maybe it's just something she was told in Sojiji by one or more of the seniors, but or by Koho Zenji, but she used to say in the early years, she said, "You cannot jump beyond the great round mirror. You cannot become God. There's always the relationship of that which is infinitely greater than yourself, of which you are a part. And yet, it is always infinitely greater than yourself. And you're always in a position relative to it of discipleship, of being its follower, its disciple." Those who become God in their own head are not enlightened. They're crazy. Because our nature is the same. We have the Buddha nature. We are part of the cosmic Buddha. When the veil dissolves, we know that we are part of it. That we are loved beyond our wildest dreams. We are of that love. Another time that we have this veil dissolved is just right at the time of death. The stories of near-death experiences and the stories of near-death experiences, people describe being welcomed by this infinite love. And to some people it will appear as Jesus, to some it will appear as the Virgin Mary, to some it will appear as a mother or a father, to some it will appear as a Buddha, to some it will appear as just a bright light. From the scripture of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, it says, I'm going to find it here real quickly. He is a light, pure, spotless like the sun. With wisdom does he darkness all dispel, subverting all effects of wind and fire. His all-illumining light fills all the world. As thunder shakes the universe, does he control his loving body? And his thought of great compassion, like a cloud from which a rain of Dharma comes as nectar down, destroys the flames of evil passions all. River Master used to say, the Eternal will appear to each of us in a way that will least frighten us and most reassure and console us. Think for a moment of someone at the moment of death, at the time of death, coming and being their spirit being, as it were, translated into the presence instantaneously of infinite love and infinite light. While they're still hanging on to the vestiges of this body and mind and this personality, what they have known of human love, human consolation, they're fragments of grief, of separation, of judgment of themselves, all these aspects of self-identity. And all of a sudden you're thrown into the infinite. The Eternal will at that time manifest in a way that is an expression of this cosmic compassion that's described in the scripture of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. Think of it for a moment like every person goes to that presence with a pair of glasses on. Some people's lenses are tinted green, some people's lenses are yellow, some are red or orange. Everyone's wearing some glasses. Some people who have done a great deal of training, undergone a great deal of conversion, there may be very little tint. Maybe, in a very few cases, no tint at all. So they just walk directly, as it were, into that light and dissolve into it. Sir Edwin Arnold put it so beautifully in The Light of Asia, the dewdrop slips into the shining sea, just dissolving into the oneness of the Eternal. There's so little self left at that time. So much conversion has happened. But regardless of the state of the being at that moment, they all are in the presence of the same infinite love, the same true nature, the same true reality. Everyone. If everyone wears his glasses that are appropriate for him or her, they all perceive it. They will perceive it, each of them, in the way that is best suited to their spiritual need, to their spiritual state at the moment. So if a person all their life has been a Christian, it may be Jesus or the Virgin Mary that they perceive, welcoming them with radiating that love. The recognition of the love is this thing everyone can agree on. It's infinite love. If it's a Buddhist, maybe it's Shakyamuni Buddha, maybe it's Kanzan, maybe it's Kishtigarbha, maybe it's Amida Buddha. I've told the story of how when I was a very young monk, and still in my 20s, but just made a teacher, I was sent over to Britain to train and be one of a pair of priests at Throssell with Rimmon Hogetsu at the time, for a year while British monks were training as a group at Shasta with her master. And she rotated a number of us through there to kind of hold down the fort while they trained, and then they came back as a group in 1983. I was over there in 78, 79, and during that time, I was in London for different reasons a couple of times. And the first time I was in London, I went. I had an extra day, basically. So I found my way to the Victoria Albert Museum, which has a very good collection of stuff, more or less heisted from Asia, along with the rest of the world. We won't get into that. But I walked into one room that was an East Asian room. I mean, these are big rooms, you know. And very, very high ceilings, beautiful, big high ceilings and big tall walls. And up on a wall, up, you know, it must have been at least, 8-10 feet or more off the floor, was this face of an Amida Buddha. I'm sure it was an Amida. And from a statue, and the face must have been at least 3 feet, maybe 4 feet in height, and similarly in from a big statue, just a stone face. And I just stood there before that face, and I just wept. I just stood there, and I just wept. I just wept. It was not long after my first my Kensho, and I was going through great swings, emotional swings. Some of them not so pleasant as that one at all. But later, after I got back to the Abbey, and later I had a vision of that same basic face, only not that face, but like on a cosmic scale. And then much later, almost 20 years ago now, in 1993, I had a lovely period of a retreat when just very quietly the devotional, really powerful devotional, but very quiet devotional feelings for Amida, Buddha, and Kanzan came up. And at that time, I wrote some hymns to Amida and Kanzan, and it was just a kind of a quiet period of a very quiet period in which I just was really kind of bathed in the love of the eternal for I don't know how long it lasted. I always kind of lose sense of time during those times, but that was certainly one of the most exquisite periods of my whole life. And I figure I got the karma of someone. I've never seen the past life that I know of. I've only had a glimpse of one past life of a Buddhist monk. But I figure I must have got the karma of someone who's deeply devoted to Avalokiteshvara and Amida, hundreds of millions of people have been, right? Hundreds of millions of people. Today, millions of people are. So it's Mahayana Buddhism, the majority of people Mahayana Buddhism, that's the focus, Amida Buddha and Avalokiteshvara. The great representatives of cosmic compassion. And I figure I'd just reap in some of the merit there. Reaping some of the merit there. And being allowed to experience something of the love of the eternal in that aspect, with those glasses on. Now, if you read How to Grow Lotus Blossom, what do you see? Look at those visions of Master wandering in on the grassy knoll with the temple up at the top and the stream of water flowing down into the waveless sea with the lotuses and strolling with the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas there. It's just more of the same. It's more of the same. I guess you could try to psychologize it, a piteous thing to do. But whatever that comes from, whatever that is, maybe there really is a real realm as real as this one, or more real than this one, where you can stroll with the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, or if you're Christian, maybe it's the heaven where you can sit at the feet of Jesus. But whatever it is, its reality is just the same as the reality of this realm, and it's just the same as the reality of any hell. It is the love of the eternal, and that is what you come knowing from a kensho. You come away from a kensho knowing. But you know within the heart of a kensho that the opposites are not the reality. There is that which is the true reality. Your master sometimes call it the immaculacy of nothingness. She'd say it's love beyond your wildest dreams. We can think of it as we will, we can call it what we will, it doesn't matter. It is, and it's the one in the driver's seat, not me, and not you. When we aspire to be in the driver's seat, we blind ourselves. We create clouds of illusion and blind ourselves. And yet it is always here, abiding here, ever giving voice to the Dharma. And we blind ourselves to it. It is always here, right now, helping and teaching and leading. This is why, at the very heart of Rinpoche Master's teaching, of the teaching of the Eternal that came through River Master in How to Grow the Lotus Blossom, is again and again, I am willing. Not I am the boss, I'm charging on, but I am willing. Please teach me, please show me the way. You, the Eternal, are everything to me. She said, trust the Lord of the house, love the Lord of the house, always ask the Lord of the house, always listen to the Lord of the house. People want Buddhism, want Zen to be kind of non-religion religion. And people hang up on the fact that Rinpoche Master so openly spoke, as I so openly speak, of the Eternal, the Buddha nature, the cosmic Buddha. Is this just another brand of Christianity that's being foisted on us in the name of Buddhism? No, this is what Buddhism is. When you experience what is real in reality. And it's what Christians experience in their own way when they experience what is real in reality. And it's what Muslims experience in their own way when they experience what is real, what is true and real and enduring in existence. You can't turn what is true and real. You can't make it as small as yourself, no matter how hard you try. It is. And As Reverend Massey used to say, the real truth does not insist on truth. So even while it is infinite, it is willing to present itself to each of us in our time of need in the form that will least frighten us and most console and reassure us. Think of the compassion of it. And then people can mistakenly then seize on that, if they're not careful, and say, this is all it is. And then again make it as small as themselves. But it is never all it is. It is infinite. We are not. And yet we are of it. And every part of us is of it. Who can fathom it? No one. Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha.